He can't turn the team totally into the Ducks. He just can't. It's not possible. Goldberg hasn't been relevant since he slimmed down. No one knows where the hell Guy went. And Fulton's knuckle puck, I mean, it's lost more than a little bit of its speed. You could probably still get Charlie Conway, at least as a player coach, though.
Live from Monster Dome, deep underneath and yet somehow still five stories above Austin, Texas, this is Inside the Locker, the geekiest sportscast you've ever heard.
Welcome, sports nerds. You have just stepped inside the locker. Mind the gap and don't feed the rancor. This is the weekly nerdy sportscast that is still looking to acquire Phil Coulson in free agency. Marvel's Free Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I am your host, Brian Salisbury. Oh, the humanity! And I am joined by Elliot Fontanette.
Quack.
J.C. DeLeon.
Quack, quack.
And Adam Beef Nuggets Charles.
Hi.
What a goose.
What a goose. I want to remind you that you can hear insightful quips like that on iTunes as well as on Stitcher.
Talk to me, goose.
You can also follow us on Twitter at ITLcast. Like the website on Facebook, facebook.com/oneofusnet. And definitely consider becoming a subscriber. We have lots of goodies there for subscribers at all levels. So definitely check that out. And use our Amazon links whenever possible, whenever you're making your online purchasing needs and whatnot. We've got a discussion topic to once again bridge the gap between sports and nerddom. We've got another scheduled visit from our corner man. But first, hold the goddamn phone. It's sports news.
Flash, the Captain and Mrs. America and all the ships at SeaQuest. These are the scores and stories.
Stop the press.
And the biggest story of the week is, of course, the trade of LeSean McCoy to Buffalo. He's being shuffled up to fucking Buffalo, just like every athlete dreams of.
Yeah, like Buffalo, the only city in the United States that people want to be in less than Detroit.
This is true. And look, I don't want to cry Lannister conspiracy here, but you have to wonder about the motivation behind trading one of the top two running backs in the league for a guy who, let's break down his stats. Who the guy that LeSean got traded for. He finished second defensive rookie of the year voting 2 years ago, didn't play all of last year, but the one stat he does have is that he attended Oregon, the school where current Eagles coach Chip Kelly used to coach. Is that what's going on here? Is that the whole reason for the trade?
Yep.
Yes, Adam says yes.
Well, brevity is the soul of wit.
I guess, yeah. So.
In a certain way, at first I was kind of shocked, but then the more you think about it, it's a little more understandable. Running back, unless you're, and we don't know what Adrian Peterson's going to look like when he comes back, but unless you're one of the top two guys like Peterson or Marshawn Lynch, for the most part, expensive running backs are kind of replaceable. Even.
Yeah. But he is one of the top two guys. He literally is. There's DeMarco Murray and LeSean McCoy. Those were the top two running backs last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's 27 years old. He's still got some years left. But statistically, anytime a running back has the type of year that he had with a number of carries, there's a huge drop off the next year.
That's kind of... And I think, and I can kind of agree with that, because yes, he is young, and I did a little bit of research on this a few weeks ago, because there's the whole thing about running backs seem to like veer off as they get close to like that 30 years of age sort of time frame,
and they're getting worn down.
Yeah, and it's not so much the age as it is the workload that you've had up until the point at which you turn 30. So LeSean McCoy is coming off of three consecutive years of having, you know, over 300 carries for those particular years. And he's not exactly a large back either. Like, you know, he's not physically imposing. He doesn't take a lot of heavy hits, but that's a lot of work over a 3 year period. And I can see it being something where LeSean McCoy will probably still have, you know, a couple of LeSean McCoy-like years left, probably this year and maybe the year after that. But when you start to get around like that 2,000 carry total for your career mark, that's when things start to, I think, wear down on you physically, and you can sort of feel it upon yourself that you're not exactly the same runner that you were a few years prior to that. And it does seem to be like around that and Adrian Peterson's pretty much gotten there, I want to say, last year or so.
And it's only been in the last couple of years that people have really kind of been realizing that and really quantifying it to a specific amount where X number of carries, despite age, means, you know, X percent drop off. Like that's kind of probably what Chip Kelly's banking on. So this probably would be the year that LeSean McCoy would have been overrated.
Yeah, and if you look at the way Chip Kelly runs his offense, it's like he sort of follows the, you know, Bill Belichick model of interchangeable parts.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't, I mean, he took Nick Foles and made him a star.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing really surprising about this is you keep hearing rumors about how the Eagles want to move up to get Marcus Mariota, who's really familiar with this offense, but they just traded away their best chip. That's the surprising part.
That's true. That is a little bit shocking. Only to get, and I can get to some degree. My guess is they're trying to unload LeSean McCoy now without the with knowing that they still could get a high price for him. Mm-hmm. But they didn't exactly trade him for money either. Like, they just cleared off cap space.
Yeah,
that was pretty much it. They got back Kiko Alonso, who could turn out like. It's not like this can't turn out to be a pretty good move for Philadelphia. It just seems like for the player that you're getting back in return is one, you don't maybe necessarily need somebody at the position. And the only thing you gain from it is, I guess, a couple years of youth. Yeah. But you're still getting a player who's coming off of a major surgery and only has 1 year of experience underneath them.
It just seems like the Bills categorically got the better end of this deal. And I'm shocked that the city of Philadelphia has not burned itself to the ground.
Yeah.
Because Philadelphia is a pretty unforgiving football town. And when you're, a second, third year coach, and you deal away who is arguably your team's best player for not much other than, you know, sis, boom, ba, we went to the same school kind of mentality. Like, I'm really shocked they haven't run Chip Kelly out of town on a rail.
Well, I mean, because he took him to the playoffs his first year. Yeah, he had a winning record last year, but they...
Two seasons, rookie coach. He won 20 games. A lot of things that happened last year. Shuffling offensive line because they had a lot of injuries. Like, I think he's earned himself a lot of clout, and he has a ton of respect from coaches even before he was an NFL coach.
Yeah, I mean, he ran 10-6 last year with Mark Sanchez behind, under center for, like, the latter half of the season, so...
Which is miraculous in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so it's... I mean... I don't know. I don't think this is going to be a situation in which it backfires on him. But it does seem like it's the second year in a row that Chip Kelly has taken the most effective offensive player and seemingly got nothing back in return for it. You know, because 2 years ago they got rid of DeSean Jackson, shipped him off to Washington.
Oh, that's true.
And you could see the difference in the offense. And Richard Sherman almost said the same thing. It was like, there's a difference in the offense when you take away a player who your defense has to scheme for, you know? Like, LeSean McCoy is a guy you have to scheme for. Even if he doesn't fit into your offensive, even if it doesn't fit into Chip Kelly's offensive scheme, conceptually speaking, he's still somebody who the defense has to respect strictly just off of talent, you know?
Yeah.
So.
But, I mean, if you look at DeSean Jackson, I mean, what did he do this last year in Washington?
Nothing. That's not to say nothing, but he also didn't have anybody. He wasn't. Yeah, nobody was there to throw him the ball.
Yeah, that's a train wreck. He's transferring to train wreck.
So it's not necessarily. It's not necessarily like did they get rid of a good player, and you can tell because they went off and they had success wherever it is they went to. So much as it is, did you see a drop off in their offense from the time at which they left? And you could definitely see that Philadelphia's offense, not that they didn't have a good year last year, but they weren't the same offense. It's not the same when you've got Jeremy Maclin and Riley Cooper on the opposite sides as it is when you have Jeremy Maclin and DeSean Jackson on opposite sides.
I agree with what you're saying, because like when the Saints traded away Reggie Bush, their offense went noticeably down because nobody had to prepare for him anymore.
Well, and it's funny you mention New Orleans, because I think the main reason why I could actually see Chip Kelly shipping off LeSean McCoy, because I think he actually does schematically see Darren Sproles fitting into his offensive scheme better. And Darren Sproles is somebody who actually, he has been in the league a long time, but he's never been the featured back before. And he's normally not ever had to be the go-to guy. So even though he's...
Yeah, because even in San Diego, he was behind LaDainian Tomlinson.
Correct. Yeah, so even though he's beyond that 30 years of age mark, he only has about 750 carries to his name. Oof. So
plus he's adorable.
Like, yeah.
Which is really all that matters.
Just a little tiny guy. Cheeks.
That's really worth caring about. So, you know, it's interesting to look at the top. If you look at the top running backs the last few years, you have DeMarco Murray this year, this most recent year, who is up for free agency. Prior to that, you had LeSean McCoy, who just got traded to the Bills. Prior to that, you had, I believe it was Ray Rice. Adrian Peterson, who's on the exempt list. Prior to that, it was Ray Rice, who's on the exempt list. Prior to that, it was Maurice Jones-Drew, who just retired today.
Yeah.
like proving once again that Oakland is where careers go to die. Yeah. You know, they talk about his drop off when he got to Oakland. He went from, you know, being in the, you know, the top three to the top five running backs in the league to 43rd.
Yeah.
Going to Oakland. Like, that's a pretty steep drop off. Like, that literally is just like this soul sucking black hole of a team. And I don't understand why people, like, Ndamukong Suh is visiting there right now. And I'm like, if you sign there, goodbye.
Well, you make a good point, because Oakland is a soul sucking wall of blackness, a punch nothing will escape. And I think I'm quoting that from some movie, I forgot. But that just shows that running backs, they're more of a, I feel like they're a luxury item more than anything else. Like,
but
you got DeMarco Murray, like, look at that old line he's running with. Like,
yeah.
Take DeMarco Murray out and put somebody else in, they'll have a decent
year. What I don't understand is, like, if we've gotten to the point where they're devalued this much and nobody seems shocked by it, and it's crazy to me, nobody seems shocked by how devalued running backs are, and I'm like, then why for the last 3 years have I been hearing nothing but, oh, you have to take running backs first in the fantasy draft. You have to. I'm like, really? Because you're saying that on one hand, and then with your other hand, you're going, well, who cares about running backs?
That's a concern, because when people give you advice, they're just taking what they have experienced and dusting it off and giving it to you because that's what they have noticed. Mm. What they've noticed, they drafted quarterbacks first, and their running backs have always given them shitty production.
Right.
So they're like, okay, we'll draft the best running back you can, but that doesn't work because you don't really know what the players are like your first few weeks of fantasy football.
Yeah.
You have no idea.
It's the harder one to predict in terms of fantasy football. Go, you know, in that respect. They always say take a running back first, because if you can get as close to a sure thing at the running back at the running back position, you have a leg up potentially over your competitors because it's such a fluctuating thing of you don't know who the next breakout star is going to be when you know, carrying the ball for the next year. So you go with somebody like a Marshawn Lynch who's been consistently giving you the exact same type of numbers for the past 3 years, and he still looks fresh. Same thing with Adrian Peterson.
And I feel like Chip Kelly is going to be, years down the road, one of the guys that we look back and realize that he was kind of ahead of the curve. Like, similar to the Moneyball thing, where the big realization they had was, like, you're not chasing number of wins, you're really chasing number of runs. You have one running back that makes X amount of dollars. If we could just get three or four running backs, or not even, maybe not four, just two or three, that can produce the same or maybe 80% of the same and add this much to our salary cap, like, that's...
I think it's going to be something similar to how Denver used to be with their running backs.
Right. Yeah,
you know, like a Denver back in the late 90s, you know, they had Terrell Davis behind the line, who was a 6th-round pick, something like that, you know.
Right.
And he had some amazing seasons. Got injured. They replaced him with I want to say like Mike Anderson or something like that. Somebody whose name you don't even remember anymore. But even he,
Jared from Subway.
Yeah, like, but even he had like a 1,700-yard season, followed by another pretty breakout season. Then he got injured, and they replaced him with Clinton Portis. They got Clinton Portis for 2 years, shipped him off.
But see, gave it to somebody really the else. First ones to kind of do that. Yeah,
I agree with that individual back. But what I'd be more worried about if I was Philly fans is watching the Oregon College play. They never win the big game.
Yeah. Like,
their scheme relies so much on speed that anytime they were up against anybody with any size, they lose horribly. And if he's bringing that shit to the NFL, it's like he needs to understand he's playing with, you know, big motherfuckers and needs to adjust.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to stomach and to see, but it's... Yeah, it's when you do break it down and kind of give it some years to evolve, it is kind of... Kind of going back to what I was saying, it's like as a coaching staff can basically just be saying to themselves, why pay $8 million to one guy who's going to give us 1,600 yards, where we can pay $4 million for three guys who are going to give us 2,000 yards?
No, I agree. I just wish he would go, okay, let me just get some beefy D and O-line people, like Wolfork. Let me just put him there. Patriots don't want him.
Very possible that's exactly what he goes. There's no way in hell he's going to get Vince Wolfork.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than because...
He wants all the money.
Well... the thing that I think makes the reason why I don't think it's that simple for him to win championships is because a lot of the, I guess a lot of the mentality on the offensive side of the ball for him is speed, like getting the ball off quickly. Don't get your, keeping the defense off balance by just not giving them the ability to settle down. So basically where I was getting at was, I think the worst, Chip Kelly's defense's worst fear is the offensive side of the ball. So it's not like They don't fear the opposing team's offense. They fear their own offense going too fast and not giving them a time to catch their breath. Which is why there's no way in hell he's going to get somebody like Vince Wilfork, who they've got to like actually be able to get back really quickly.
But see, I think that's the fatal flaw in what Chip Kelly's trying to do, because I've watched a lot of these games and the refs seem to consciously slow that game down.
Yeah,
because they don't think it's fair. I'm not saying it's fair or not, but if you're going for speed and you want people that are conditioned and can just run up and down the field. That's great, but if you get into a championship game, I can't imagine the NFL just letting you pull that if they got another team that's built to be just a standard Power 10 style, just running down your throat, and we set and we go, because you're changing the nature of the game, and I don't think the NFL wants that game changed like
that. I think they'll be okay with it, especially if they see that it's not like they're invincible. Okay. Like, because, I mean, this past year, when they played against Seattle, they couldn't do shit. Mm-hmm. Like, and part of the reason why they couldn't do shit is because once you get it like 1-3 and out, mm-hmm. and then the defense has to go on the field, and then they start getting, you know, run upon, even if the other team isn't scoring,
you're still wearing them down.
And then if your offense goes back out again and gets another 3-and-out, you've only taken like 60 seconds off the clock.
Yeah.
And your defense has to go back out there again and again. This happened with them with Dallas, happened with them against Seattle. Like, it's one of those like feast or famine kind of things.
Yeah,
like, right. You have to hope that you can get at least Once you start going, mm-hmm. then they're really difficult to stop.
It reminds me of like when you were playing Madden back in college, or like you're playing Madden with your friends and everybody's throwing those Hail Marys and it's all working. All these passes are working until they fucking don't. And then you're like, well, you don't know how to run the ball in this video game.
Yeah, I just don't know why Chip Kelly is trying to turn the Philadelphia Eagles into the Oregon Ducks. I mean, especially when it'd be so much cooler to turn them into the District 12 Ducks. Just do that. Just take on Iceland. Be a hero. Come on, Chip Kelly. Step up to the plate.
Yeah. Just go beat up some kids, please. I'd like to see that.
I'm just saying. Like, the Eagles have produced a few players that I would not put it past to beat up some kids. Oh, yeah. That's all I'm saying. Hey, this just in. Daily Show host Jon Stewart kicks Seth Rollins in the balls on Monday Night Raw.
Oh! Stewart went low at Rollins!
More as that develops. Moving on to our next story, Kurt Schilling is apparently campaigning to star in the remake of the 1994 comedy, My Father the Hero. If you guys didn't follow this, apparently Kurt Schilling's daughter, Gabby, just won the starting pitching spot for Sal Regina. I guess it's her high school?
No, it's a college.
Is it a college? Okay, I didn't know. I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, she got her college paid for.
That's awesome. So she got a scholarship to play for Sal Regina.
Thank God. It's not like Kurt Schilling had any money.
Yeah, I know, right?
Well, he actually fell victim to like some bad investments and was kind of conned out.
Was he in Broke? I feel like he was in the documentary Broke.
I think so, but only because not because he like partied all his money away, but he made bad investments.
Like, that happens.
He got built out of a lot of money.
Well, that's why we have Kevin Bacon acting again.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But the problem here is that as soon as Kurt Schilling took to Twitter to congratulate his daughter, here come the trolls. And I don't even think troll is a fair word. I mean, these are cretins. These are just absolute bottom-dwelling bastards. I mean, these people came out and said some like really sexually degrading, horrible things about Gabby, just to be dicks. One, the two main violators here are a guy that goes by Primetime227, another guy who goes by Nagels_Bagels. The problem here is that one of these guys... What?
227?
Yeah, Primetime227.
The sitcom that was a spinoff of the Jeffersons in the 80s?
I'm pretty sure this white kid has never heard of that.
I'm just saying. Primetime227.
The other problem is that this guy, Nagels Bagels, also known as the sports guru, is actually a... And let me get to that in a second. First of all, I gotta say, I love the way Kurt Schilling dealt with this. He basically went Liam Neeson on these guys. I don't know who you are, Primetime227, but if you keep harassing my daughter, I will find you, and I will kill you. He actually did find out who they were,
mm-hmm.
And he posted this thing that just said, the sports guru, yeah, he's a DJ named Adam Nagel. DJ is a bit strong since he's on the air for 1 hour a week on Brookdale student radio at Brookdale Community College. How do you think the place feels about this stud representing their school? You don't think this is going to be a nice compilation that will show up every single time this idiot is Googled for the rest of his life? What happens when a potential woman he's after Googles and reads this? The other clown? He's VP of Theta Chi Fraternity at Montclair State University. I gotta believe if Theta Chi is cool with a VP MVP of one of their chapters acting like this. I'd prefer to have no one I know in it. Also, does anyone attending Montclair State University have a student handbook? If so, you can pass it along, because I'm pretty sure there are about 90 violations in this idiot's tweet. So he went ham.
And I believe that second guy had a part-time job working for the Yankees.
He did, as a ticket taker, and the Yankees were like, you're fired.
That's great.
Like, not only that, but the Nagels Bagels guy has been taken off the 1 hour. Like, literally, how do you get fired? Brookdale Community College released a statement on Facebook saying the student involved had been suspended. I'm sorry.
We stopped eating in bagels.
How do you fucking get fired from being the Brookdale Community College sports DJ?
Threatening to do the things that they said they were going to do, like, and that's such a weird, like, why his daughter?
Like, yeah, what?
Yeah,
like, they didn't even
not
make
like his daughter's
sense.
Famous. Like,
look, I don't want to paint Yankees fans with a broad brush here, but I'm also not going to finish that sentence.
Well, you maybe get a paint roller.
I'm just saying, like, you don't fuck with a guy's daughter. You don't like. I don't know why you would write suggestively. Degrading, horrible things to any woman on any social media, because it's fucking creepy.
Well, here's the thing. This is what we're seeing is, like, the evolution of the internet. Like, 15 years ago, internet was the Wild West. You could do whatever the fuck you want. There was really no repercussions, but the law and social values are finally starting to catch up to the internet, where if people do this, you don't get in a flame war with the trolls. You just go, okay, let me see who you really are. And I'll contact your mother.
Yeah, anonymity
I'll contact your world.
Yeah, anonymity is a little bit more difficult to get to, you know, to get by on now, and it's pretty fucking wonderful for me.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, Kurt Schilling, he went on a couple radio stations talking about it, and he was like, it was easier for these guys to get dealt with as fast as they did because, you know, he is famous, but it's really, I mean, anybody can do it. Like, if anybody says really racist and horrible things, like, you can look them up and find their employer and be like, hey, your dude is, like, saying this stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, one of my favorite, I have two favorite Tumblrs. One of them is they get racist fired.
Yeah.
Another one is this woman, she doesn't even solicit this. She just posts what people send her on OkCupid if it's vile. And she posts it and she informs their parents about it. It's like, you know, your son sent me a picture of his dick and, like, very vulgar things, but I don't even know him. Yeah. And it's like, don't do that. That's not cool. It's like, well, maybe you would act right if you knew that the internet is not this place where you can just, you can have your id on full display. You have to actually act like you have some common sense.
Yeah. And it's just so weird, like, going back to what a, not that it's okay to do it to anyone, but, like, his daughter isn't famous, like I said, but, like, years from now, Kanye West and Kim Kardashian's daughter, like, everybody knows her name. And so, like, she's going to be subjected to some of this stuff when she's older, and it's definitely not okay, but, like, it comes with the territory a little bit, and it shouldn't. I mean,
plus, it's like, not... I don't understand how, like, oh, she's going to be playing baseball leads to, then I'm going to fuck her. Like,
yeah,
I'm sorry, like, you're a serial killer in the making. Like, if you're like, baseball, cool, up the ass. Like, there's something fundamentally hardwired wrong about your brain, and you should be in prison.
Yeah, there's something about, like, that human nature impulses. I remember, like, God, it was like 10 years ago now, being on forums, and you would see people with this picture of Hermione when she was little, with like a date on it when she was legal, and it's like, do you really need to count down?
No,
like, is that something you need to do?
you don't have a shot, buddy.
It's like,
even so, at the point at which you're anticipating it, that means you're physically attracted at the moment, and you're just hoping for it to become legal eventually.
Exactly.
It's like, I doubt Prince Harry was sitting there like, oh, I can't wait.
Yeah.
Nah. Well, I just want to once again commend Kurt Schilling for going full Liam Neeson on those motherfuckers and getting justice served. Well done, sir.
Slap him with a bloody sock, man.
He's a closer, man. Oh, yeah. He's a closer. So we're going to move on to a story about a rugby star who's about to join the NFL. Jared Hayne, who is one of the best rugby players in Australia. Now, as I understand it, rugby is almost exactly like football, except scarier.
Yeah.
So this is basically a universal monster entering the NFL for the San Francisco 49ers. They see him playing running back and kick returner, but JC, maybe you can help me with this. How does he not actually count against their 53-man roster?
He is on some... It's not like it's technically an exception list.
It's technically almost like a practice squad.
It's like an NFL tryout list.
Yeah. Is that what they're calling a futures contract?
Yes.
So it's like he's basically got a contract bet against him succeeding?
Are the guys from Trading Places involved?
It seems
similar to the way the NBA will draft a player from Yugoslavia and then just like let him play in the Yugoslavian pro leagues for like 5 years before they bring him in. Mm. So it seems like that sort of thing. Although with the NFL, it seems like they're going to let him, he gets to like work out in their facility, and I guess he gets to like work out with the practice squad, but he doesn't just count against that.
He's not on the active roster. So like you can employ more people than just 53, but you can only suit up, I think, on any given week, a total of 53.
Yeah. Either that or the 49ers went up to Roger Goodell and be like, you're going to make up some bullshit exempt list. We're going to hire this rugby guy.
Yeah.
I'm just going to work out in our facility.
I think we should start calling him Rugby Rudy. Because seriously, his Australian rugby contract was going to be worth $1 million, and he signed with San Francisco for $100,000.
Yeah.
He literally took a 90% pay cut to pursue his dream of playing in the NFL.
Yeah. Although, if you've seen the movie from the 90s, Necessary Roughness, I do wonder how the NFL is going to like screw up his game, because in that movie there's a scene with this guy who's coming over from Australia, and he comes out to practice, and he's not wearing pads, and the coach is like, hey, you're not wearing a helmet. And he goes, oh, Australian rules, we don't wear helmets, mate.
Oh my God, it could be the first 49er to play without a helmet.
Yeah, and then he catches the ball, gets knocked out, is passed out on the field, and the coaches are like, well, I mean, he caught it.
Yeah. I'm watching some highlights of the guy right now, and he is ridiculously fast. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
They said they clocked him at a 4.5. It's like a 4.52 or something.
Good
like
Lord.
That.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting.
Like he's basically it's interesting that the reason why they're actually taking him to running back is because of the transition from the rugby game to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they're looking at his highlights, something like that. He has more of an offensive mindset,
yeah.
But size wise, he actually fits more in line. He's like a Cam Chancellor, you know. He's 6'2", like he's 6'2", 220.
Cool. Yeah,
and he runs a 4.5. So he's strong safety size.
He's Captain America, just say
kind of. Yeah,
and I think the unique thing about him,
except just he's Australian,
from what little rugby I've seen over the years, this guy's a north and south runner, whereas rugby runners typically, you know, go east to west.
Yeah.
And a guy who's willing to go north and south the way he is with no pads is really interesting.
Yeah, he's got some balls down under there.
I remember reading somebody that posted, like, somebody who has experience playing both sports. And the way he described it actually was pretty interesting, because when you think of, you see rugby, and you see the fact that they play without pads, and it's, you know, full contact, and it looks like it's anything goes. Yeah.
Because it is.
Yeah. But the way he described, like, the differences between the two games in terms of, like, the impact of a hit was kind of interesting, because he was like, NFL players will, and, like, rugby players know a certain kind of pain that NFL players just can't comprehend, only because it's, like, the game is consistent, it's ongoing, on it, like, it's, you're combining the most strenuous aspects of soccer with the impact of football,
right?
You know? Yeah. And it's like it's just continuously going.
Like,
so
no good for anything.
Yeah. So, yeah. But as far as the impact of a hit goes, he's like, there is no rugby player on the planet who is in any way prepared to take an NFL hit, and it's because of the way that the way the game is formed.
You have to be slimmer to be able to go up and down.
Well, when you're on the defensive side in rugby, you're not necessarily playing it's almost like hockey in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not playing the player so much as it is you're playing the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be constantly on the lookout for not necessarily hitting the guy so much as it is looking to see whether or not he's going to pitch.
Well, there's less specialization, it sounds like. It's like,
yeah, and there's hardly ever those like full force dead on hits, because you're never really going to tackle the guy with like a 10-yard sort of lead up to it.
Right.
You're more trying to prevent him from, or prevent the team from getting behind you, sort of thing. So, and the only time you ever get like those full force hits is when you're trying to chase somebody from behind.
Well, maybe that could be something that, you know, far in the future, that the NFL could sort of learn from to keep his players a little safer, is, you know, maybe learn from rugby and, you know, have a little less contact in the NFL than they have right now.
And take their helmets off.
Yeah. And there's a lot to be said too. Like, when you're playing in a game and you don't have a helmet and you don't have pads, you're not going to go and
you're not going to lead,
you're not
with,
lead
head.
With the head. So, right. Like, you're going to find other ways to tackle a guy.
That's how you teach them not to lead with the head. You just take their helmets off.
And that's part of the reason why it's like, I guess the guy said, like, there is an element to an NFL hit that rugby players may just, that first hit is going to feel pretty painful. They'll get used to it faster, but it's not going to feel the same as, like, getting hit as it is in rugby.
I don't understand why everyone's okay with the NFL doing this, but when I tried to bring in a rugby player to win our T-ball championship when I was six, everybody got real upset. And it may be because he was an adult rugby player and smashed all those kids in the dirt. But I thought the crossover would work, and clearly the NFL agrees with me. I'm just, whatever.
How did you know a rugby player when you were six?
Don't worry about it, okay? There's chat rooms. So moving on
from
there. He
also knew Michael Jackson.
Right? Update on a developing story. We have now been informed that Daily Show host Jon Stewart still kicked Seth Rollins in the balls on Monday Night Raw.
Oh! Stewart went low at Rollins!
J.J. Watt is apparently setting up his own cabin in the woods, but not the one from the Drew Goddard, Joss Whedon horror film that we've been fawning over. This is apparently a very different cabin. JC, what's going on here? Why is he seeking the solitude of Henry David Thoreau all of a sudden?
So he came out a few weeks ago saying he's going to train in the off season at a minimalistic, his words, cabin in the woods in Wisconsin. Minimalistic.
So it's like, you know, just a very rustic, you know, wood cabin, maybe mud floors if he's really going the whole nine yards. I mean, there's a cot, perhaps.
Yeah, not really.
No?
It's a 600...
Thousand square foot.
No, it's an $800,000 4,500 square foot cabin that sits on 35 acres. Has two garages, three kitchens.
Wait a minute.
An elevator.
Is this the Foxcatcher Mansion?
Yeah, what wait a minute. I'm very confused
here.
They
called him Golden Wood.
How is this a cabin?
Because, I mean, you know.
It's wood.
It's made of wood.
Because it's made of wood and electricity and money?
Yeah, pretty much.
So it's basically a wood mansion. Like, so they cut down all of the trees in the area and they made one house from it.
Well, they just turned it into money and they made the house.
Yeah. That's but, I mean, he is kind of, you know, roughing it a little bit. He's 2.5 miles away from Starbucks.
Hey, you don't get your venti latte.
Yeah, it's roughing it.
He's probably, like, you know, running there, or, you know,
he probably is running there.
So, you know, I think we talked about him mentioning, you know, a few weeks ago that he wanted to do this, and we talked about it being like in Rocky IV when Rocky goes to Russia and trains like in the middle of Siberia in that cabin, and he's in the snow, and it's like real old school rustic training. This seems more like the facility where Ivan Drago trained is where Watt is going.
Yeah, it's seems like that.
It's actually probably fine, because the problem with a J.J. Watt cabin in the woods, like the movie, is that no matter what ancient object you foolishly touch in the basement or what Latin scripture you recite, the nightmare unleashed in any scenario is always the same. It's just an angry J.J. Watt who tackles the shit out of you. Like, that would be a boring movie.
That's fucking terrifying, though.
Yeah, but it's like 30 cubes, and they're all J.J. Watt, just, like, ready to go.
That'd be awesome to see J.J. Watt appear as one of the monsters in a Cabin in the Woods 2. Like, a Cabin in the Woods sequel is just...
That would
one
be
of the guys
pretty cool.
One of the guys that gets summoned is just J.J. Watt.
Would be the first time J.J. Watt shocks somebody.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, J.J. Watt, good luck with your rustic wilderness adventure.
Did they really say rustic?
No, I'm just using that word a lot.
but he used the word minimalistic.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
The fuck he says?
Maybe compared to his mansion that he lives in, it's somewhat minimalistic.
The blowjob machine is broken most of the time.
The blowjob machine is always
broken.
You know
what's going to be crazy, though? If he comes back next year and has like 30 sacks, everybody's going to be buying one of these fucking things.
Before we move into our next story, I do want to preface this by reminding you that the NCAA has stated several times that what they're really all about is the education of their players. So remember that when I tell you that Vanderbilt coach recently threatened to kill one of his players.
I'll fucking kill you!
So that happened. JC, you want to tell us a little bit more about this story that once again proves that the NCAA is utterly full of crap?
Attempted murder.
Attempted murder. That's what we're about.
When the Vanderbilt's last game was over, the coach, Randy Stallings, began yelling at one of his players because his player was clapping in the face of an opposing player, and that's not sportsmanlike, and so he started yelling at him. And he was caught on camera saying, you know, I will fucking kill you. Which is, you know...
Wait. All this sprung up because the coach was mad at the player for being unsportsmanlike.
Yeah.
So the response is to threaten to kill said player. That's more... Yeah, you know, that's way more in the spirit of the game.
Sometimes
I mean, that's how you withhold. That's how you uphold sportsmanship.
Yeah. With an iron fist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Be a good sport at your own peril.
Yeah. The most fearsome I'd ever seen my high school football coach. It's one of my favorite memories from practice. So my
junior, speaking of murder.
Yeah. Speaking of, yes, it's a good segue.
We thought that the coach was going to murder someone. So my junior year, my head coach has two sons, a senior and a freshman. Freshman who, you know, was on the varsity because, you know, maybe he was good enough to be on the varsity. Maybe he wasn't, but he was the coach's son. He was okay. The senior was one of the best running backs in the state. And so we're at special teams practice, and we didn't have a punter at the time because our punters were the soccer players. And so they were at soccer practice. So the stud running back was the pretend punter. It was well known in practice, no matter the scenario, you do not hit this guy because he is one of the state's best running backs.
Mm-hmm. He apparently can't take it.
Right. The younger son had already kind of heard rumors about how we didn't like him because he was a freshman. And he was just the coach's son, and he was like very go get him, like work hard, went balls out. And he's like Rudy, basically.
Yeah.
An annoying Rudy.
Yeah. And so we go through one punt, and the younger one, his name is Mike, he runs through, and he almost hits Mark. And the coach is like, hey, told you, don't hit Mark. It's okay. Goes through a couple times. This time, he runs through, doesn't land anywhere near Mark, but the coach's back is turned. Mark pretends to fall down. He falls down pretending that he was hit, and he starts screaming. Coach turns around, starts chasing the younger one, because I think in that moment he forgot that we were at practice.
Kill your boys.
I fucking told you not to hit Mark. And finally somebody would be like, Coach, what are you doing? He's like,
that sounds like a dad.
That is a great example of how flopping can get you the call that you want.
Like LeBron was just sitting there. Like,
yeah. Wow. And this happened to him when he was a freshman, so he didn't live this down the entire 4 years.
Yes!
I really thought you were just going to say he didn't live to see senior year. I thought that was going to be the end of your story. Yeah. It's like, oh, and that kid died. mysterious circumstances.
See, like that shit like that's a good lesson for like teenage boys, because they forget that their fathers are we used to be your age. We have a, like, they have a switch. And, like, these teenage boys, like, they're getting to that point where they're just starting to feel their oats. And they're like, unless, like, you need to sometimes hear that message that he can knock the fuck out of you if he feels like.
Yeah.
He's chosen not to.
Yeah, and a couple of years after that, we were telling the coach this story. And he had a very vague memory of it. Didn't really exactly remember it. And he goes, oh, yeah, it sounds like something he would do.
Well, we can't possibly end our news segment without talking about the genius of the most brilliant mind of our time. And of course, I'm referring to Swaggy P, who has now entered into an extended feud with ESPN anchor Robert Flores over Iggy Azalea. JC, as our resident gossip queen, I'm gonna need you to bring me up to speed on what's going on here.
Okay, so this all started with Swaggy P telling a story to a tabloid reporter about how over the All-Star break, him and Iggy Azalea went to some tropical vacation, and a dolphin was trying to kill Swaggy P.
I already love this.
Is that Darwin from SeaQuest?
I don't know. And the reason why the dolphin was trying to kill Swaggy was because the dolphin knew that Swaggy was Iggy's man. And the dolphin wanted Iggy.
Oh, for God's sake.
Jesus Christ.
And so Robert Flores was recounting this story during a break in SportsCenter. And he made reference to Iggy Azalea. And he mentioned the line, so while dolphins are trying to kill you, your girlfriend is trying to kill hip-hop.
He did it such great delivery.
Oh, yeah. Didn't leave it at, so Swaggy...
What Swaggy should have said was nothing.
Yes. Yeah. Let should have die. Said, nobody yeah. would have noticed.
That's true. He said, you know, hey, Roflo, I'm sure you and I are going to run into each other at some point. To which Roflo geniusly said, if he takes a shot at me, he's probably going to miss.
I believe, actually, the exact words, and this is so beautiful, the exact words, is Robert Flores said, if you look at his numbers, there's a 70% chance that if he takes a shot at me, he's going to miss. And that sound you heard was the sound of his dick and mic hitting the ground at the same time.
The thing Swaggy P, I think, doesn't get, like, that, like, I feel like you learn when, like, you just, you learn a little bit about the world. Insults never really bother you unless you think they're true a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
He probably thinks it is a lame-ass rapper.
Well,
he can't say
and
it.
Robert Flores is right about the shooting because Nick Young is at 36% on Jesus the season. Christ. 268th out of 282 players.
Well, then, yeah, you know, saying that, that reminds me of the story we had like a few months ago where Swaggy P like went for a shot, turned around, thought he made it, and just walked off and missed as a direct opposite to Stephen Curry, who knew he had made his shot,
oh, yeah,
and then turned around. It's like, you're not Stephen Curry. You're not even like
you're
Chris Bosh.
You're not even like Tandoori Curry. Like you're the worst.
You're not Takar. You're like off brand masala wok.
That's what I'm saying. That's I'm
together.
Hungry.
Both he and Iggy are just so obnoxious. Like today she or this week she even had a quote saying that she was glad she didn't win the Grammy for best rapper. Because people hate her enough already.
And only because she's white, too. That was...
Oh, yeah, is that why? That's why she...
And she's like, well, you like Eminem. I'm like, well, Eminem, like, he actually grew up in Detroit. Like,
Iggy, first up, you're the worstest. Yeah. Okay? All right.
So the accent that he raps with is the accent that he speaks with.
It's his!
That's true, too.
I had a story that I read just a second ago. Uh-huh. That it's a good story. We have so many stories about football players that are just shitty.
That's true.
There's a university in New Jersey where the football players they were hungry. It was like dorm room late at night. They were hungry. They needed some stuff. Just, you know, college, you need some shit. And like they went to a convenience store. They didn't know it was closed. The thing was open. They walked in, left some money, and walked out. Well, they got called the next day and they thought they were in trouble. Store was like, no, just thanks for not robbing us. You take you on a shopping spree.
But thanks the NCAA banned all of them for inappropriate shopping meth or some bullshit.
Because like they were caught on camera just like looking around like, I guess we're going to leave some money. So, I mean, you know, you hear like the Ray Rice shit and you hear all the bad stuff. It does do some service to remind that a lot of these athletes just want to play a game they love.
They just want to eat food.
Yeah, they just want to eat food and like not starve when they're playing college football.
And if you just joined us, Daily Show host Jon Stewart still definitely totally kicked Seth Rollins in the balls on Monday Night Raw.
Oh! Stewart went low at Rollins!
Well, that's going to do it for the news segment, but now it's time to put up your dukes. Yes, even you, Frank Dukes, because it's time we win another round with our corner man.
Let's get ready to rumble! I'm a corner man.
This guy is a wrecking machine.
Well, Vince is back with us. Thanks for joining us again, Vince. And you know what? I don't feel like this is going to be a very long segment because even though we've got three fights to talk about, these were three of the shortest fights I think we've yet discussed on this segment.
Well, the beautiful thing about mixed martial arts, I find, is even in the shortest fights, there are so many little intricacies to notice. A couple of these different fights, all three of them came from the most recent event from UFC, UFC 184, which is headlined by Ronda Rousey versus Kat Zingano for the women's bantamweight title. But a couple of the other ones are particularly interesting. And two-thirds of these actually ended up ending by submission, which, because of the popularity of 50 Shades of Grey and the popularity of submission in this country, both of these countries, I guess, since I'm in Canada, I've decided to call this segment this week 50 Shades of Pain, which I think is apt.
Vince, you're very lucky that you're good at what you do, and I'm going to let this name slide because you're reminding me yet again that movie exists. But you know what? It's apt. You're right. It's apt. So let's do this.
It's the Sherman Williams of sports.
Yes.
Well, the first fight we're going to take a look at was a couple of smaller names, at least for the casual fans. Alan Joban versus Rich Walsh. Alan Joban is one of the guys out of a famous fight camp from Brazil. Probably the most prominent one right now, Nova União. And Rich Walsh is most prominently known from the season of The Ultimate Fighter, where they had sort of a country versus country thing. They did Canada versus Australia, and, you know, not to slight any of the fighters out of Australia, but you could tell that they had a pronounced disadvantage since just the fight culture is not nearly as much there as it is in Canada. So even if they were skilled, they didn't have the kind of competition to hone themselves on that you have when you have guys like Rory McDonald and George St. Pierre who train out of Canada.
Arm the Australians with like a bar, with like a beer bottle, and it's a totally different story. Well,
this is what I'm saying. I think the fight culture, like the UFC fight culture, is not as prevalent in Australia because they just do their fighting in random bars.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It was pretty evident with this one because Walsh was the bearded guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he could tell he was just like, he was just straight brawler.
Yeah, yeah, you absolutely could tell, like, he was preparing for an alligator.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
That's a knife.
Exactly. That's who they told him. It's just like, what, you're having me fight a dude? Well, that's much better. Okay. I thought that it was really interesting. Like, it's a testament to his talent that despite a lot of his teammates getting eliminated, he was the one who won that season of The Ultimate Fighter. And, yeah, they gave a lot of these other different fights on the card real ended by submission, but this is one that I felt was worth noting because these two guys threw down this fight, and I was wondering what you guys was your takeaway from this.
I mean, this one it seemed like Walsh was kind of in it the whole time, like maybe it was going to come down to a decision, and it was going to be interesting because of the two very distinct fighting styles. But then out of nowhere, Jobon just clocks an elbow to the temple and done.
That was one of the most brutal finishes I've seen because as soon as that elbow hit the temple, you know, Walsh's legs went completely wobbly and his arms dropped. And it was like he was seconds away from just falling flat on the mat. And then like there was this last, like, you know, when you see like a dead body start twitching, like one last twitch that kind of like straightened him upright. And the ref was still like, no, you're pretty much dead on your feet.
I always find stoppages like that very interesting because a lot of people who will watch it will be like, what? No, he was still, like, they think that because he's standing, that means that he's still in the fight.
Obviously, he's alive.
Yeah, he's alive. He should keep going.
Exactly. And I suppose if you're, like, a veteran like John McCarthy or Herb Dean, who's been reffing fights for going on a decade, and you know the fighters really well, you can kind of have a better idea for like, okay, I'm going to let this guy fight out of a bad position. And a lot of the times they can come back from it. But most of the time, it's like, no, the definition for a stoppage of a fight is a fighter not being able to intelligently defend themselves. And if your brain stem is making you stand up, and that's the extent of your defensive technique.
Stay on feet. Yeah. Stay.
It was like watching.
Still a vertebrate.
It was like watching him fight one of Herbert West's creations from Reanimator. It's like that shouldn't be.
That's it. Shouldn't be exactly. I think that's an excellent summation.
Yeah. I'd say pretty much at the point at which your fighter looks like he's at the end of like the Mortal Kombat finish him pose, and he's just kind of like wobbling back and forth. You should probably just call it there before somebody gets your spine ripped out.
And it's kind of like I think what he means by fans thinking the fight should continue is because sometimes these knockouts are so weird, like your legs go limp for a second and then you're like back up, but no, nah, man, that's your legs went limp, you were done.
Yeah, you were so very very done.
There was one famous fight about I guess it'd be about a year from now or a year previous, I guess. I'm also a time traveling MMA commentator. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah,
I knew it. Canada has access to time travel. They're not sharing.
There was a fight, a heavyweight fight between Cain Velasquez and Junior Dos Santos that went the full five rounds, but Herb Dean was criticized for not stopping it because the last two rounds were essentially Cain Velasquez using Junior Dos Santos' head as a speed bag.
Jesus.
No, seriously, go back and watch the footage of that fight. It's kind of hard to watch because, like, when they went to go into the fifth round, Junior Dos Santos said to his corner he thought that they were going into the third. Like, he could not remember the past 10 minutes.
Wow, I'd say that's a pretty good indication that the fight should stop.
He's like Billy Bob from Friday Night Lights.
Or maybe he really just never learned how to count. You don't know.
That could be it, too.
It's just a translation error. Like, hey, English isn't his first language. He's like, we're going into the five. Five, don't three.
Like, 1, 2, 5 is what, right?
That's how count work.
Is how numbers work, yes? Junior Dos Santos is all heart, but sometimes heart gives you a face only a mother can love. So moving on from that fight, the first of our two submission finishes came from Jake the Juggernaut Ellenberger versus Josh Koscheck, which Jake Ellenberger is a very interesting fighter at 170, because when he's on, he's one of the most brutal finishers in the division. It's just that he has this tendency to go into a defensive shell. Like, I find that a lot of fighters who are very explosive don't like getting bullied. So if you take the fight to them, then they kind of clam up and they don't let their hands go. They don't try different things or be as aggressive as they normally would be. And Jake Ellenberger is one of those guys. He had that issue when he fought Rory McDonald, which, not taking anything away from him, Rory McDonald is ranked 2 or 3 in the division right now. Like, he's a legit contender. So him fighting Josh Koscheck, and Koscheck coming off of, 2 brutal KO knockout, losses to Tyron Woodley and Robbie Lawler, who is now the current welterweight champ, is kind of an interesting look into the dynamic of, like, okay, both of these guys are, like, 0-2, but the people who they're 0-2, against are, like, the champ and the number one contender. So it was especially interesting going into this, seeing, like, technically these guys' backs are against the wall, but it's not as if they're past their prime. And the finish of this fight was particularly interesting, because Jake Ellenberger finished it with a choke known as a north-south choke, which, for those of you who haven't practiced jiu-jitsu at home, it's actually a really difficult choke to finish, because of the way your shoulders are positioned and the way that you create pressure on the carotid artery. But yeah, well, what did you guys think watching this one?
I thought it was interesting. Josh Koscheck, even in the moments where it seemed like he had kind of an advantage, he looked like he was drunk. Like, the way he was fighting was like, it's like when you go to a bar real late and there's that one guy's like, what are you going to do? What's your problem? What are you going to do? And like, even when he's throwing punches, I'm like, something, it was very early in the fight, maybe he took a blow to the head that I just didn't notice, but he kind of saunters around the ring like, what? Let's go, let's do this. And even when he's throwing punches, I'm like, he looks really inebriated out there.
That's a good way to describe it, because it's even interesting. It's even more interesting to me now, Vincent, having you describe Ellenberger's tendencies, because it kind of played out the opposite of that. Like, I think at one point, Ellenberger even kind of had his arms outstretched, like, are we going to fight or what?
Are you just going to keep dancing around? Yeah.
And then that's when Koscheck just kind of lunged at him, and it was all over from there.
Well, that's the thing, is one of my pet peeves about when this happens in fights is when both guys aren't being active, and then after, like, 3 minutes of both of them not being active, one of them kind of throws their hands up and goes like, well, come on, come at me. It's just like, no, motherfucker, that's your job.
It's like the South Park where it's like, it's the bro-off. It's like, what you want to do?
What's up, bro?
Whenever a fighter is saying, like, well, come on, aren't you going to hit me? It's like, well, if he's not going to, then, like, it's like this Canadian gridlock thing.
You know you can.
Yeah. You don't need to wait for an embossed invitation.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that finish, though. Like, so earlier we talked about how it was an interesting place to stop the previous fight. Like, in this one, Koscheck was foaming at the mouth, and he was clearly, like, passing out. Like, what was up with the ref waiting as long as he did?
Well, like I say, one, it's a very difficult choke to finish, and, okay, it's called a north-south choke because it's normally done from a position called north-south control, which is, it's chest-to-chest, and the two guys are facing in the opposite direction. And the choke is only slightly, you don't move out of position too much to get the choke, except that you kind of distribute your weight a little bit further down to where your shoulder is kind of pressing into the guy's carotid artery, and you have them in kind of like a reverse headlock. Except instead of using their arm or their shoulder, like you would in an arm triangle choke or something, you are just using your shoulder and your body weight to press down on it. And the difference between having, like, a choke that it sucks to be in, but it's not gonna knock you out, and one that has Josh Koscheck looking like he has rabies is, like, a quarter of an inch. And, as well, the fact that that choke is obscured under the shoulder, also, I can see how it would be difficult to kind of get a read on on his face to be actually able to say, like, okay, he's out. I mean, when I saw the photo afterwards, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, no, that's, he's gone. He's totally gone. But I can also understand why the ref would be hesitant to stop the fight.
Because maybe he's not losing, maybe he's just rabid.
He's just getting mad.
And we don't want to discriminate against people with rabies in the UFC. That's not what we're about. We're an inclusive group.
Well, I've heard things. The Nevada State Athletic Commission is talking about rabies as a performance-enhancing substance.
Well, you do have to take a lot of shots
it's
for like, it.
Is so. It foam or was it Alka-Seltzer? Did you just watch Little Giants beforehand?
Could be.
God, I haven't thought about that scene in 20 years.
But yeah, no, I mean, Jake Ellenberger is one of those guys who's always been on the cusp of a title shot. Like, he's not quite top two or three, but I would count him in the top five, because just when he's on, he's on. So I really hope that this is an indication that his game is developing, which, interesting, and an excellent segue into the third and final fight, is that Ellenberger trains with Ronda Rousey, and he has gone on record as saying, like, yeah, I think Ronda would beat, like, 75% of the male fighters at 135, because she's just that good.
And Vince, in the time it took you to state that sentence, Ronda Rousey won another fight.
Yeah, exactly. And, oh, man, the finish of Ronda Rousey versus Kat Zingano
was also the beginning!
Yes! Exactly. And I should say, I really like Kat Zingano. Brian and I watched her fight against Amanda Nunes, and Kat Zingano has heart for days. She got beat up really badly in that fight, came back with a dominant win, and she's just my favorite fighter to watch. She can just really take a beating, and she's like, no, man, it's just gonna make me stronger. So the, like, secondhand cringe that happened when she was just a little bit too reckless within the first couple seconds of the fight, and against other competitors, you might be able to get away with that, but you leave an arm out for Ronda Rousey, and she's going to take it home with her, which is exactly what happened.
Well, right before...
she's the predator.
She'll take it as a trophy. But right before that happened... Zingano came in, and you could tell she wanted to prove herself early, and she wanted to make a statement early, so she went in for the takedown, but, like, the counter that Rousey put on that takedown, you couldn't tell who actually initiated the takedown, and I just felt like, I imagined that scene in Anchorman, and her just going, like, I immediately regret this decision. Yeah.
That's exactly it, and I mean, it's interesting, because the thing I opened this segment with is, it's amazing the little details you see, and when you look at, like, the slow-mo replay, Ronda not only pulls off one of the most innovative armbar positions I've ever seen, like, I've never really seen someone do it that way, because normally when you get an armbar, you kind of cross your arms across your chest and kind of use your body weight and sit back with the arm going up and down your chest and then use your hips on the elbow joint to, you know, attempt to break it. But with her, she did this really interesting thing where she, like, swept Kat Zingano onto her back, but then Zingano tried to initiate a scramble, get to her knees, and Ronda managed to isolate an arm and, like, hooked her hip around her shoulder and just kind of slightly moved her arm to the point where she almost didn't even, like, grip onto Kat's wrist or anything. She just kind of pushed her elbow joint against her hip, and Kat was forced to tap. And I was just sitting there like, that is absolutely beautiful technique.
Yeah, that was a crazy type of armbar, because, yeah, like you said, I think whenever she does manage to lock an armbar on, it seems like the referee does trying to give the fighter a couple seconds to maybe work their way out of it. With this one, it's like, oh, no, you have to stop this right now.
Yeah, like, it was over so
fast.
She's
like, she's got the entire 135 pounds of her on her elbow.
Can you just, I can imagine that crowd being like, fuck!
Well, no, that's the interesting thing.
No. Half of the tweets I saw after this event were just like, great, I paid $50 for a 14-second main event. I'm fucking pissed. Like, my friend Tim was just like, I lost $20 on that fight. I'm fucking
Like, it's crazy. I mean, Ronda Rousey's had, what, three fights in the past year, and she's fought a total of, like, what, 70 seconds?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, yeah. It seemed like to me, like, most people weren't upset. Like, that just might be my bias in that I'm a huge Ronda Rousey fan, but it didn't seem to me like anyone in that building was really upset that they had just seen a 14-second fight. Yeah. Everybody, it's kind of like Tyson later in his years. If Tyson would have, or even like the McNeely fight that ended in 89 seconds, like, that was bullshit. People were totally okay with a 14-second fight in this instant, and it's weird. She's a weird, strange phenomenon.
Well, that's it, is I look at this fight and I'm like, one, I would really like to see Kat Zingano get another chance, but I know she's really going to have to earn it back. But as well, I'm like, who in the division is going to, like, even slight, like, who do you look at and say, like, I would like to see them fight Ronda Rousey because I think that they would pose a threat. And no names come up.
See, I think it's high time that she's allowed to fight the dudes.
When she fought in the Olympics, she, like, won her weight class and then won the open weight class, which is exactly what you think. It's all weight classes and both genders. And she won it. She's just, her technique, like, the thing, she coached on one season of The Ultimate Fighter, and she brought her mom in to be, like, a guest coach, because she was the one who trained her, and she said, like, the most telling thing about her, and she's like, my mom trained me, because her mom is, like, a national judo champion as well. So she was like, you remember Nick Nolte in Warrior? She was essentially, like, the lady judo version of that.
Nice.
Nice. Ah. So you bring up the possibility of other opponents for her, and people keep bringing up Cyborg, who this weekend tweeted out a picture of her weighing in at 175. You're more familiar with the fight. It might have been, I don't know, it was just a picture that she tweeted. I mean, you're more familiar with this game. Like, how easy is it for a fighter like Cyborg to cut weight to get into Rousey's class?
Well, it's very interesting. Because of the fact that women's MMA hasn't been around for nearly as long as men's, I'm interested to see how the dynamic with weight cutting works. Because the thing is, fighters will try to keep their body fat as low as possible, because just by basic biology and basic math, the lower percentage of body fat that you have, the higher percentage of water that you can have in your body. And so the larger margin you can have for, okay, I can reduce the amount of water content in my body, lose that water weight, and then weigh in. But two factors. One, women have a higher body fat percentage that they can healthily carry in order to perform at a high level. And the fact that fighters at lower weight classes do not cut nearly as much weight because of the fact that if you cut a higher percentage of your body mass, it becomes very, very risky. Now, Cyborg has fought at 145 her entire career because she is not a small woman. Like, she got busted for use of, like, HGH and steroids, and she has since said that she's gone clean. But if she's cutting, like, 30 pounds to fight at 145... I don't see how she would be able to just be like, yeah, I can do an extra 10. It's like, I, you're going to lose a limb and, like, strap it back on?
Yeah.
So I don't know how she would do that. And scarily enough, every time I see video of Ronda running striking, I'm like, I don't know if Cyborg has the advantage, at least technically, in striking anymore. Ronda's hands look amazing. Like, she's training with, I can't remember his name, because it's one of those, like, Armenian names that I just cannot keep in my head.
Her head coach is Edmund something.
It's like Tam Zurian or something like that. But yeah, he's done a lot of work. Like I say, he does work with Jake Ellenberger, and they train together. So, you know, Jake Ellenberger's sub game coming along is very telling. But it's just, she looks so smooth, her boxing looks so, like, her footwork is excellent, her head movement is excellent. I mean, if Cyborg were to beat her, it would be on raw power, but if she ties up with her, thing about judo is it's effortless, and Ronda is all technique. So she will send your ass flying through the air, and it won't be because she's got huge, like, bulging biceps, it's just because she knows perfectly where your weight is and how to use it against you. So right now, the only other thing is, like, the possibility of Cyborg coming back, and there are rumors of, like, Gina Carano wanting to, like, make a comeback, but I think if Carano comes back, Rousey stomps her, personally.
So, in other words, the best we can hope for is Ronda Rousey, who I've taken to calling She-Hulk, against Cyborg. That's a comic book matchup that I am ready to see. Vince, thanks so much for coming on and for breaking down these fights with us.
It's always a pleasure, gentlemen. Hopefully I'll get to talk to you again next week.
All right, thanks, Vince. And we're going to move on to our final segment of the evening, our world-famous roundtable discussions. Our worlds are very small, but believe us, they are. This is very famous. So the LeSean McCoy abrupt ending, dealing Shady McCoy to the Bills effectively and abruptly ends an era in Philly, an era marked by a highly effective ground game. And we've decided to engage in one of our roundtable discussions about eras of geek time that were abruptly brought to a close that somewhat resemble this highly confounding NFL transaction. And, you know, Adam, I'm gonna start with you. What's one thing you can think of from the geek world, that an era that abruptly came to a close?
One that came, I mean, it ended faster than it began, which was Edgar Wright getting taken off of Ant-Man.
That was pretty abrupt. You know, it was an era. The ending was abrupt, yes.
Yeah, the ending was abrupt.
Well, yeah,
and
yeah.
It was an era that had been established, because he'd been working on that since before Iron Man came
correct,
out.
Yeah.
So
the one that, it was the first thing that came to mind when I thought of a situation where somebody seemed like how they fit into the system, and then all of a sudden were just, like, shoved by the wayside because they apparently don't fit into the system. Yeah. So, and it's the one thing I think that that's come out of this whole, you know, the Marvel cinematic universe that was pretty disappointing. Because it's not really that Ant-Man may still turn out to be just a perfectly fine, even entertaining movie, but it's always going to be one of those things where you're going to want to know, what did Edgar Wright have in mind, and what did we not get the opportunity to see?
Yeah, and what I want to know more is, like, what was holding it up? Was it him just, like, giving them drafts they didn't like, or was he just not working on it? Like, were they doing a bunch of rewrites? Because that shit took for fucking ever.
Well, but the other thing to remember, too, is, like, the way the Marvel Universe ended up being structured, I'm not convinced that what it was wasn't Marvel going, we kind of see Ant-Man as a second-tier character that would be better served once everybody else is established. So, you know what I mean? Like, because that's how they thought so far in the future by that point that I could easily see them going, look, we love Ant-Man, we love what you're doing with it, we just think it's going to be a character to better introduce after the first Avengers. And maybe Edgar Wright took that to mean, okay, well, that's great, because that means I've got time to really develop the script and make it what I want. I'm not convinced that it was the time element that made Marvel go, okay, we need to move on and do something different. I don't think it was because things were, I mean, with the amount of time that he had to work on it, I don't think that's what it is. I can easily see it being some kind of creative difference. But the weird thing about all of this is that no matter what happens with Ant-Man, if it's good, we're going to assume that it's good because of the groundwork that Edgar Wright put in. And if it's bad, we're going to assume that it's because of the guy that they literally the guy that they brought in to be the
it's a no-win situation for the new filmmaker.
It is a no-win situation.
I don't know, like, I've sort of just assumed they threw out his treatment.
Oh no, they did not throw it out. No. I mean, that,
like, we've had reports that they kept everything. Like,
yeah, well, they didn't scrap the script and start over.
Okay.
They kept what he's written. So, I mean, Peyton Reed...
And then, like, there's no way in hell, like, when you've got the movie scheduled to come out within a period of, you know, a year, that means you've got to get started filming really fast. That's way too quickly to turn around. It's like a whole new script. So,
yeah, I just got the sense that, like, they didn't like what he did. Like, that's the one I was reading things.
And I think to
but it's
to
such a weird that, it's such a weird thing too, because it's like, how did you not know that in the first 2 years, or the first 4 years, or the first 5 years that you didn't like what he was doing? You know, like, there's, I just don't see Marvel being like, yeah, just go write whatever you want and come back whenever you want with a draft and we'll just take your word for it. Like, I don't see them working that way. And it's just weird to be like, once everything's handed in, then they go, oh, we don't like this. Like, they had to have known where he was going with it. It couldn't have been a surprise. I don't know. The whole thing is weird to me. I obviously don't know everything that went on behind the scenes. There's just a lot that doesn't make sense. But I do agree that his departure was very abrupt after a very substantial era of time on which he was working on it. So,
yep.
Good example. What do you think, JC?
I know one of the ones that you're going to go, so I'm not going to steal that one, but...
good, because I would murder you.
Written by the same guy, Sports Night.
Oh my God, yes!
It's also on my list.
Yeah, I think people know, If you didn't know, I'm a huge Aaron Sorkin fan. Everything he writes, I'm all in for. That show, there aren't a lot of movies that like make me cry, but Sorkin has these moments in his TV shows, not so much his movies, but in his TV shows that are just fucking hit you, man. Mm-hmm. The way the first season ends with a character coming back after having been away for a while, it's just like, just coming out of nowhere. Like, that's his stuff he does. It's really great. And yeah, that show tied in sports really well. It was topical. It's interesting the way history repeats itself, because a lot of the issues that show hits on are really relevant today.
Yeah.
Just way ahead of its time. People didn't appreciate when it was on air.
Because it was Sorkin. It was his first series, right? Because he did that right before he got onto West Wing. Actually, he was going to, he had actually, I think, already intended to abandon it because he wanted to go do the West Wing.
Well, yeah.
And like, it wasn't something that he considered. I think he wanted to stay on forever, because he even abandoned the West Wing after, I want to say, like, the fourth or fifth season.
Didn't he get fired? I don't know if he abandoned
it. Well, I think that it didn't quite have, it was in a bad time slot, which Brian might touch on for the show he's going to talk about. It didn't seem like people get that kind of, that seems to happen to Aaron Sorkin. Like, shows don't get whatever viewing they expect, and they just kind of cut bait really soon. And he has the foresight enough to be able to, like, you know, provide his show some closure despite the fact that they end way too soon. Like, I'm grateful for that.
I remember when the first time I started watching sports, because I remember when I was a teenager, I was watching it, and I didn't get, like, a lot of it didn't necessarily go over my head, but I wasn't familiar with that kind of, like, that kind of framework for what looked like a sitcom, because it didn't seem like it fit. And it's weird, because when I rewatched it on Hulu, I think it was Hulu when I rewatched it a few years ago and started going through the entire series with my wife, that when you watch the first, I want to say it's like the first 10 to 12 episodes on Hulu, and I don't know if they aired this way initially or not.
Oh, the laugh track?
But there's a laugh track on it.
That's on the DVDs, too. Good.
Yeah, so it's like, it doesn't fit at all with how Aaron Sorkin's humor works. Like, and the back and forth banter, because it's so quick. And it seemed almost like he was being forced into a formula or something that was so ingrained with how sitcoms were supposed to be, that it didn't work until they started to remove things like that. And then you started to see elements of the Aaron Sorkin type of writing and directing that the rest of the rest of the series that he would start to go on to do would take form. And that didn't happen until, like, the latter half of the first season.
Yeah, the best part about Aaron Sorkin is that he writes dialogue like songwriters, like, write lyrics. Like, his his dialogue, it has pitch, it has timbre. Like, you can just let that dialogue play without any background music, and it's great.
Yeah.
His biggest problem is that he wants to say stuff sometimes that isn't in line with the subject matter he's on. It's like, he wants to make this grand statement about society, but you're not writing about the White House anymore. He's sort of having sometimes to crowbar it in, and I'll go with it, because I love Aaron Sorkin. Like, but that's his problem isn't his dialogue. It's just sometimes he gets a little bit too on his high.
Yeah, like, he's a stage writer, I think, at heart. So to some degree, I think it's almost like he's always trying to, like, there's always some kind of thematic element that he's always trying to tie an entire episode together. Like, it's something you don't necessarily see up until maybe, like, the last 10 minutes of a show.
It's great.
Everything starts to come together, and you start to realize that's what you're getting at. I get it now. Yeah, that kind of thing.
And he has some of the best moments that you'll ever see in any series. Just, like, I mean, just go to West Wing, the two cathedrals, the speech in Latin and English.
Oh, yeah.
From Bartlett. Like, damn.
Just a quick fact check here. Aaron Sorkin quit writing on the West Wing after 3 seasons.
Wasn't it something to do with, like, he was, like, caught doing mushrooms or some shit?
No,
like,
he just left.
Okay.
He
just left.
It's like, he only seems to have some kind of, like, it looks like he has projects that he wants to get after, and he gets really excited about, and then after a while, I mean, it's like most things, you can usually tell after maybe, like, the fourth or fifth season of any good, like, any good show, there's a point at which even the writers just want to stop, right? Like, they've told all the stories that they can think that they really want to tell in this universe, and they want to go do something else.
And the good writers leave, unlike, Ronald Moore, who did Battlestar Galactica, who, around the third season, you could tell he wanted to write for Mad Men.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, just fucking leave.
Go. Yeah, I get it, you're talented, and, you know, don't get me wrong, like, I love this show, but don't bring the show down because you want to go do something else. Man, go do something else. I'll watch whatever it is you decide you want to go write.
Yeah.
But like, don't, if the show's going to get diminished, I'd rather it get diminished.
Don't poison the well.
Yeah. Like, I'd rather like decrease a little bit because you're at least attempting mm-hmm. to, like, you're attempting to go off and do something else. And you're trying to bring somebody in who looks like maybe they're as excited to take over the project yeah. as you were to start the project.
Just because you don't want to live in this village, don't poison the well.
Right.
What do you think, Elliot?
Mine's going to be a little unpopular, but I think the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies got a pretty abrupt ending, and it wasn't even Sam Raimi's fault. They forced him to put Venom in that movie. When if you watch that movie and you cut Venom out, that's a good movie. If you just take Venom out of it, if somebody had a fan edit, like, the themes that are going in make a lot more sense with Sandman, and they were going to, I think, have Vulture.
My only problem with the Dance Sandman...
Dance Jazz Club, man.
Yeah.
But that's Venom.
That's like, Venom. That's part of the Venom story.
And the thing about that, though, he dances in the dance club. The sweet thing about that scene is the evilest version of Peter Parker is he's an emo douche. That's how good he is.
Yeah. That's maybe why I don't like Peter Parker. Not even Tobey Maguire, just Peter Parker in general. But my bigger problem with the Sandman in that movie... is that I don't understand giving the Sandman a heart. I don't get that. Like, the Sandman that I read in the comics back in the Ditko days was just like this snarling idiot. Yeah. And frankly, I'm like, he's like, oh, it's sweet. He's got a daughter. Okay, fine, whatever. But frankly, it just, I don't know. I think at that point I was just like, let the Spider-Man villains be the evil, you know, douchebags that they were in the early days of the comics. I'd be okay with that.
I see what you're saying. Then he could have just had Sandman be a mustache trolling villain, or not even have any. But that may be going too far.
Or a comic book villain.
He could just have him be a comic book villain.
Yeah.
But I think the better thing about that entire movie was seeing the character development of Hobgoblin, James Franco's character, that he came in the end to fight with him, and that'd have been really interesting going forward. Especially if they could have split Venom off into a new movie.
Yeah.
And have them develop that. But talk about an abrupt ending. The ending. Of Spider-Man 3 is just, we don't know what happens with Mary Jane and Spider-Man. We're just sort of like, well, that's over.
Bye. Yep. Well, this is done. This whole era of Sam Raimi and Spider, which is, you know, it's unfortunate because I don't like what has been done with it so far, as far as rebooting it under somebody else. I'm really excited to see what happens now that it's back in Marvel's hands and what they're going to do with it, because frankly, I'm not a big fan of Mark Webb's interpretation of Spider-Man either.
That was going to be my second one.
It has its charm. It's not bad.
Yeah, I guess not.
There are things. No, there are definitely things about it that I prefer, even to Raimi's Spider-Man.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But overall, I mean, I'm not going to. I don't think I'm ever going to desire to rewatch. I mean, Spider-Man 1 or 2. It's definitely no more frequently than I do Spider-Man 2 from, you know, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, I actually like Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2. For mine, I'm going to go with the other Aaron Sorkin show that kind of died too soon, and that is Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. And the very unfortunate thing about Studio 60 is it premiered the exact same night as 30 Rock.
Yeah.
So in one night, you had two competing shows that were both about the production of an SNL-type sketch show, one of which was a straight-up comedy, and one of which was more of a dramedy, written by Aaron Sorkin and starring mm-hmm. Matthew Perry, who obviously I love from Friends, and Bradley Whitford. Mm-hmm. And that show was so beautiful. Like, it was funny, it was poignant, but when those moments that you talk about, when it hit its moments, it was a gut punch and a half. Yeah. Opening, the first episode of that show is Judd Hirsch going on a network style rant. Just basically Sorkin's version of "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore."
Yeah,
and it ends like his speech where he calls everyone. He like basically ends up calling everyone whores. And right as he does it, it's like Studio 60, and it's like, fuck me, I guess we're on board for this ride now.
And if that doesn't get you locked in, if anything in the first episode doesn't get you locked in, it's like the second or third episode, the one with John Goodman.
The Pahrump, Nevada episode. Like that, it's one of the best pieces of television ever constructed.
I need to go back and watch that series.
Oh, it's so good.
I mean, I kind of talk about how he has the foresight to give his shows closure and an ending. Like, it's cool that he did that, but 14 episodes is a decent amount, but it's like, I want more.
Yeah.
And even Sports Night. Like, Sports Night gave us 42 episodes. Like, as much as I want more, I'm kind of good. 14 is not enough.
But the great thing about the way Sorkin writes is I feel like all of his stuff, it has such the same themes. And I mean this in a good way. I mean this to praise him. I can watch those all as one series, honestly. Like, I can watch Fortnite, West Wing, Studio 60, and Newsroom. He's all basically taking apart the American experience from different perspectives.
Yeah. And it's a weird thing. It's like I'm grateful that he doesn't let things go on 6-7 seasons way too long, like Supernatural.
Just you gotta get some people to be pissed.
I'm sorry, that show is supernaturally long.
Do people still like that show?
Murphy loves it.
Oh dude. We have an entire podcast on One of Us in which the Wayward podcast, no matter what those guys are talking about, they inevitably talk about Supernatural. It's like
their Pacific Rim.
It's like the Supernatural podcast unofficially of the website.
I find myself in that weird spot where it's like I'm grateful that he doesn't allow his shows to become that. But I also just a little more, like 14 episodes, like
it's
just
a little.
Episodes.
It's a little too little.
And a little like if you want like more Sorkin, he also wrote The Social Network.
It's true.
That was real. Like one of the best things about that movie is the dialogue.
Yeah, and I'm gonna Moneyball once again.
Yes.
Because again, what Aaron Sorkin is best at is finding the drama in the weirdest, smallest places, and you can talk about finding the intrigue and the drama in the numbers of behind the scenes baseball player acquisitions is beauty. Like it's art in and of itself to find the interesting facets of that. So that's definitely Studio 60. If you haven't checked it out, definitely find a way to do so. Any other examples, guys?
I have a pretty obvious one.
What's that?
Firefly.
Oh fuck yeah! Just, I don't know how we haven't said.
I mean, we can go on and on about all the show about all the great television series that didn't make it past one season or two.
Yeah,
you know, Firefly, Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah,
you know, it's
Undeclared.
I like Undeclared a lot. Yeah.
One thing I was thinking about, and since Web Spider-Man was my second one, but not to bring up Spider-Man again, but and I don't know where the licenses are with this one, but for a little while it seemed like Lionsgate was going to do Marvel Knights, like they had Punisher Warzone,
Ghost Rider,
which Ghost Rider wasn't, you know, what we wanted it to be, but Punisher Warzone was great. Like I wanted more of those Marvel Knights movies, and I guess I don't know what happened with those licenses. It seemed like Lionsgate was willing to take those movies in the darker turn that the comic books were in, and that's looking forward to that.
I think they have reverted back to Marvel, and they're going to be making Netflix series.
Because Daredevil was one of those knights.
Yeah, see, I'm curious about what Daredevil's going to be, because if Daredevil's going to be kind of like what Punisher Warzone was on that forum, then that's, I know, I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
I'm more of that.
Blaming it all on the Knights of Marvel.
Knights of Marvel!
Giving them superpowers, beating those really freaky villains.
Living it up!
Living on the Knights of Marvel! I'm sorry.
How's it going, Adam?
I think it's because we were talking about Saturday Night Live and you just think
Jimmy
Fallon.
Then I just get the fucking Bee Gees stuck in my head. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, there are a lot of situations within the nerd world where, you know, there are very distinctive eras that come to an abrupt end. And
actually, are there, you know, a lot of the TV shows that we talk about ending too soon happened at least, what, 10, 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. Is there anything recently you guys have seen that...
I tell you... It feels like the networks are so gun-shy now, especially about big nerd properties. They'll give most series at least 2 seasons so they don't have to hear this shit for the next 10 years.
Two words. Almost human.
You were going to say almost human.
Oh, almost human. Yeah. That was a really great, very nerdy sci-fi show. It was a lot of fun to watch, and gone immediately.
From this season, I think people made fun of it coming in, but I ended up liking it. Selfie.
Selfie?
Yeah, Selfie.
I don't even know what that is.
It was with Karen Gillian and John Cho.
Yeah.
Selfie.
Yeah. There's a pretty decent...
How do I not... Like, I literally have no concept of
really,
this.
Because it lasted, what, maybe like was, 3-4 episodes?
No, it was like 8 episodes. Yeah.
Scanning, nothing.
There's 13 on Hulu that you can watch now, but it seemed too reliant on the will-they-won't-they card that a lot... And then they kind of shot that wide a little too soon, and it's... I mean, I could see why it ended.
That'll ruin your night. Yeah.
Well, it's like it's what they said on Studio 60 when Amanda Peet's character was trying to recruit the HBO white writer, and the show was too smart for NBC. Selfie was too smart for a cable show. I mean, for a network show, it should have been on FX or something where they could really delve into what they.
The right network does make all the difference. I mean, the reason Almost Human got canceled is because Fox is a canceling machine.
Yeah.
I don't even know why Fox greenlight shows.
I don't either. Especially
they should just be like, we're going to put your show, you're canceled.
Yeah.
Like, in the same meeting.
Especially because the way Fox made its name when it was launched back in the early 90s was they would put shit on that nobody would put on, just keep it on to build an audience. Like, nobody was going to put on Married with Children back in the day.
Yeah.
They kept it on for, like, what, 15 seasons or
something?
It
was really long.
So, anyway, but yeah, Almost Human was the one I was going to get at.
Yeah.
It was over the past couple of years, it was the one that I watched consistently from like week to week, and I was excited to see the next week. And I really wanted, what I'd hoped was going to happen was that people were actually going to give Michael Ealy some kind of recognition, because I think he's somebody who could be like a very significant, prominent Hollywood actor given the right kind of role. And I thought that was going to be like his breakout thing, because the way in which he did, like playing that kind of character really fit for him. And he really brought out like an element to it that I don't think a lot of other actors could probably do.
Yeah.
But I'd love to see Michael Ealy get some kind of like
some recognition,
some kind of like Bourne style role. Yeah. You know,
he deserves better than ending up in a Tyler Perry movie.
Yeah,
I'm going to reach way back for this one, but as much as I like Halloween 4, there was an era that was being built in the Halloween franchise and in horror that was going to be very unique. If you guys don't know this, Halloween 3 Season of the Witch has nothing to do with Halloween 1 or Halloween 2. It's a standalone story about these masks that they're selling to children and this like sort of cult behind it and what the effect of it is, yada, yada, yada. That was supposed to be the start of the new Halloween franchise, where every couple years they would release a new Halloween movie set in a completely different town about a completely different... Mm. It mirrors very much what's happened with American Horror Story.
Hmm.
It was going to be like that. But when Halloween 3 bombed, specifically because people went to the movie to see Michael Myers and he wasn't there, they decided to bring him back. Which, again, I really like Halloween 4, but part of me thinks that there was an era that was never realized in that has now become popular with American Horror Story, so obviously there is an audience for it. Maybe there wasn't at the time, I don't know, but the idea that every Halloween movie after 3 would have been in a different town, a different story about a different horrible thing, I wish I could have seen that.
Yeah, I do think it's really interesting how television has become the place where people can actually seem to take risks.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Something like that is something you typically don't see in film. So. Right. It happens in the American Horror Story, and now it looks like it's happening with True Detective.
Yep,
you know,
yep, True Detective same way.
It's a whole new. No characters are crossing over. It's a completely new atmosphere and completely new storyline, and that's really exciting for me.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's not because it's not Monster of the Week. It's Monster of the Year.
Monster of like the season.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, because there were only two styles of storytelling in TV. It was like you either do Monster of the Week episodic, where everything is its own compartmentalized story, or you do one huge overarching story.
Yeah.
But no one had ever tried, let's do, and again, I'm gonna call it Monster of the Year, where it's like we have one overarching story that lasts exactly once. It's very British.
Yeah.
That's very much like in the British style of television, where it's like one series, and this could be it. We could just make this one.
Yeah.
You know,
and
who knows?
And honestly, that's better. Like, I like that season, and I feel like they're adapting to the way we watch TV now. Like, you don't sit down every week and go, it's 7:30 on a Tuesday, I'm watching this show.
Right.
You go, fuck that, I want to wait until all the shows are lined up and I have Saturday free.
Yeah.
Like, that's
6 hours here, 6 hours there.
But at the same time, they know if you try to stretch one story over 5 or 6 seasons, sometimes you run into that Lost problem.
Yeah.
Where it starts off really strong, but then when it comes time to tie up all the loose ends, you're like, fuck, what did we say that was? I don't know, just do something.
And, you know, you're right, because like, the Lost problem also is, like, if you're watching everything on binge, you can notice dips in quality really easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I watched all of Lost in 3 weeks, and like, I thought it was a cliche, but you could tell, too, they didn't know what the fuck they were doing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They were just like, Michelle Rodriguez comes in, the guy with the Jesus stick, whatever.
Yeah. Sure, whatever. That's Lost in a nutshell, guys. Yeah.
And I think the great thing that happened because of that experience with Lost, I think now a lot of creators seem to have the idea that we had better at least have an idea of where we're going to go with this. Assuming that this turns to be successful, there's got to be an end game.
Yeah.
And now your audience has to be aware that there is one. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that was actually what saved Lost, was not the fact that, because you can see it teeter off, like, by the time I got to season 3.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until they announced that, okay, we're making 7 seasons, and then that's where it stops, because that's how you keep your audience engaged, because you give the impression that you know that there is going to be an end to it, and that they've thought about it, even if they haven't.
Yeah. Right, right, right. Yep, well, that's guys, thanks. This was a great discussion.
What about Saw? We need more Saw movies.
No, we don't. Right? That era is fine.
Know, actually,
being over.
It's funny because I actually thought Saw would have made a much better television series than it would a TV franchise.
But when it came out, you know, 2004, it wasn't quite.
I was kidding. We don't have to expand upon Saw.
No, we don't.
That's good. No, but I mean, can you imagine that though? It's a television series almost from like the perspective of a serial killer who. Each episode is like a new person whose life he's putting on the line.
Here's what I would do.
Given reason.
Here's what I would do with that show is I would put it on the like DIY channel. and it would be about him actually building each trap, like going to the hardware store and like, I need a ream of barbed wire. And then he buys it, and then he goes like,
this sounds like the Leslie Vernon movie. Just a TV4.
Totally. Yeah, awesome. Well, again, the end of an era in Philly for sure. And as we've talked about, there are many different ends of many different eras in the geek world that have been just as abrupt and just as striking. So that's going to do it for the show. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I want to remind you yet again, you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at ITLcast and like the website on Facebook, facebook.com/oneofus. You can also follow us individually on Twitter. I'm at Bryguy Salisbury.
At ITL Elliot.
At JCDelion1.
At @_beef.
And want to remind you yet again, if you haven't become a subscriber already, please consider doing so and use our Amazon links as much as humanly possible. But again, that's going to do it for this week, so I'm going to end the show the way I always do, paraphrasing the great Rocket Raccoon. When it comes to sportscasts on the internet, ain't no thing like us, except us.